You're listening to episode 12 of Fear the Boots interview series. In this episode, we talk with Fred Hicks of Evil Hat Productions. Running time for this episode is 58 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Chad.
My name is Pat.
And my name is Chris.
And also, we are joined by Wayne, though he is not on the mics at the moment. He's dealing with an emergency from work. But he will be entering at some point here, about halfway through the episode. He's sitting in the other room. And we are also joined by Fred Hicks from Evil Hat.
Hello.
Howdy.
Fred, we'll start this the way we always do. If you could go ahead and just give our listeners sort of a resume of who you are and what you do.
I tweet. I blog. I do layout for game companies, both my own and others. Others including Hero Games and Margaret Weiss Productions. My company, that is our publishing house, is Evil Hat Productions. We put out games that you may or may not have heard of. Spirit of the Century, Don't Rest Your Head, Swashbucklers of the Seven Skies, A Penny for My Thoughts. And I also do a podcast with my friend Chris Hanrahan called That's How We Roll.
You won an Annie for Spirit of the Century, am I correct?
Yeah, Silver Annie.
It had the best acceptance speech I have ever heard. Our game has a gorilla flying a biplane on the cover.
It's got a gorilla on the cover.
Yeah. That was the acceptance speech.
How the hell are we up here?
Fred, there's something I want to ask you about, which is in your resume, you listed right at the top of your jobs that you tweet and that you blog. And I'm curious why you lumped that in with your resume.
You know, it's enough of a part of my day. It's enough of how I get some marketing and other elements of signal out there in terms of the message that I want to put out. You know, it's enough of my day-to-day life that I don't feel I should not say it's there.
Well, and that's one of the things that several people have commented to us on about your company is within this industry, and by this industry, I mean the entirety of the gaming industry, whether we're
it's vast, vast empire.
Yes, the vast
multi-billion dollar, multi-global.
The vast multi-global?
That is awesome.
Well, it is multi-global because, yes, we do have those orders on Titan.
Yes.
That's pretty.
There are dozens of dollars in them.
But you know, from the big companies like WotC all the way down to the little independent bloggers and podcasters, there's a real interest in protecting numbers and business intelligence and decision-making processes and whatnot. But that is not at all the approach you have taken. You have taken a super transparent approach with Evil Hat. I'm curious if you could talk about why you chose to buck the trend and how that's worked out for you guys.
Sure. There are a few things. To speak solely from a sort of self-interest perspective, when you put numbers out there, when you're giving people as much of a view into what you're doing, they end up feeling more connected, more invested, more like they're a part of what's going on. They can see the effects of their own patronage of your company expressed in those numbers. So people who have taken that effort to find me and find where I'm running my mouth constantly about, you know, our numbers and various other things that are going on, there's a feeling that they've sort of been brought into the fold. They're part of the family. And that in turn turns into customer loyalty and sales and all of that stuff. So there's kind of a self-serving element to it there.
I want to interrupt you one for 1 second, Fred. Is that measurable, though? I mean, because, you know, I absolutely 100% agree with you, because in my regular world job, we kind of follow that same belief pattern. You know, through even though it's a TV station, you can't interact necessarily with people via TV. Through our website, we do a lot of that. We are finding that that interaction almost creates a sense of ownership. A greater ownership, even though in reality it's not.
Right, exactly.
I mean, so is there a way in which you can really measure that, though, or do you just get that anecdotally?
Yeah, it's one of those things that I don't know that you could measure it numerically in any sort of way, unless you were doing some sort of directed and extremely boring marketing research study. But whenever I come across like an Evil Hat fan somewhere else on like RPGNet or forum or blog or whatever, and they are one of the fans who has plugged into that information stream, I feel like I'm seeing them talking with more of a sense of authority about what they know of what's going on with Evil Hat. I feel like they are better able to speak as an advocate. And hopefully, if I've gotten the message out there the way that I want to, they're also doing it in a way that doesn't come off as being a dick, which I really want to have that kind of that sense of, you know, Evil Hat is a relatively positive company with a lot of positive fans.
That's really cool that you do that, because I'm seeing the opposite effect right now with another game company, Catalyst, where they're going through some problems right now, to say the least.
And you don't say.
Yeah, and the fans are coming out, and everybody has an opinion. Everybody's breaking into camps. Everybody's getting very vehement, very angry, and nobody has all the facts. Some people have some facts. Some people have other facts. Some people have a certain version of the facts, and some people just don't even know what the hell they're even talking about.
Yep, you're going to get that in any sub-tribe within the greater geek tribe that we find ourselves in. But when I do see it happening in something that I'm actively participating in, I try to kind of get in there and go, guys, let's find something to celebrate here, and let's not focus on the stuff that we're bitching about, because that's just not interesting.
Right, right.
Is that something, though, you've ever found yourself regretting, that you've stepped out there, been honest about your numbers, been honest about why you guys chose to do something, been honest about something you're working on that hasn't been released yet, and that's backfired in the sense of the fans. Now suddenly a process that before they wouldn't have even known about, now they're able to question an attack or...
I hear what you're saying. There's always going to be someone who's going to look for some loophole in what you've shared and see if they can weaponize it. But I feel that's going to happen whether you're sharing information or you're not. Yeah. If you don't share information, they're going to weaponize the silence. And I find that a hell of a lot more toxic.
At the very least, you can just come back and say, hey, these are the facts. We told you the facts.
Yep. And if you go over to the Dresden Files RPG website, there's a now thankfully outdated page on there titled something like, so when's it coming out? And in it, I spend something like 20 paragraphs talking about the entire history of why the project has taken as long as it has, the various things that happened along the way and that sort of thing. And yeah, there are a few people who have looked at that and used it as a, you know, springboard to proclaim how they've lost all patience with us. But I've found that far more people, at least in the vocal set, and that's really all that you can measure, look at that and are like, wow, somebody actually speaking straight to me, speaking to me as a peer, not talking down to me and giving me, you know, an idea of what's been going on in a way that I walk away feeling informed as opposed to marketed at.
Speaking of the Dresden Files, is this your first exposure to a licensed property?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. And it was way bigger than us when we first got our hands on it too.
Well, and that's kind of my question is that how have you found the difference being between dealing with licensed property and having to deal with people outside of your own little realm that you deal with as opposed to, you know, creating your own stuff from scratch?
It's a hellacious amount of work, and it's doubly hellacious because we feel a personal sense of obligation to Jim Butcher, the author of the Dresden Files, because he's actually a personal friend of mine from way back. And this is one of those things where we did not go out and seek the license sought us, in part because of that friendship connection. So not only do you have the pressure of doing right by the fans.
Is what you're saying is that he approached you to do this?
Yeah, his agent, she's a gamer geek as well. We had made a small splash with the free version of the Fate rules that we'd put out a number of years ago, and it had gotten noticed by the Indie RPG Awards in their first or second year of happening. And we got several awards as, you know, best free product, that sort of thing. And Jennifer Jackson, Jim's agent, somehow became aware of this. I'm not sure exactly how. And, you know, she's the one fielding requests from various folks as to, hey, you know, are the rights for Dresden Files for an RPG available? And she was talking to Jim, and Jim really wanted someone to do right by his baby. And she said, well, don't you know some, and this is a laughable phrase to us at the time, mind you, don't you know some award-winning RPG designing friends? Why don't you ask them to do it? And I know none of this, of course. And then I get this email from Jim, more or less outlining that conversation, saying, so would you be interested? At which point I spent about 15 minutes picking my jaw up off the floor. And then I went and turned to my business partner, Rob Donahue, and shared the email with him, and there was a similar pause. And then we turned to our wives and said, this is going to involve investing some money in Evil Hat, which has previously been sort of just a label under which we do some free shit. Is that okay? And our wife said, this is your dream project. Go! And
that's awesome. That's awesome on a lot of levels.
Yeah.
Wives are cool, man.
Yeah, they are.
They're what
they
make
right.
Our little hobby industry go in a lot of ways. And that's more or less what kicked Evil Hat into becoming or trying to become a commercial publisher as opposed to a brand under which we ran the occasional convention game and put out some, you know, free downloadable rules. Dresden Files is kind of what kicked us into this mode of putting out Spirit of the Century and Don't Rest Your Head and so forth. They were games that we were happy to put together and put out there, but in a lot of ways they were kind of us beta testing this whole being an RPG publisher thing.
No, I'm sitting here digesting it because that's actually a really kind of a cool story. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, when yeah, you, it's, you it, out, we do everything backwards. You know, we well, put you all know, the numbers out there, and the rights come to us.
Well, and that's how, you know, it should work, isn't it? Because, I mean, clearly, the name Evil Hat, you know, it sounds like you're just doing this because you just want to go and, like you said, just kind of screw around and beta test. It certainly is an attention-getting name, but it's not necessarily a name that you might apply to a legitimate, we're here to make money type of company, but then here you are like, actually finding success.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, exactly. But here you are, you're finding some success, almost, without even trying.
I think he was saying that the Evil Hat name sucks. Is that what you're saying?
No, yes. No, no, no. That's not.
Because that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, yeah. Your company name blows, but you have a cool logo.
Look, if you want to kick his ass, he lives in Iowa. There's not that many people up there, so pick one at random. There's at least a 50-50 chance you got the right guy.
I'll just point my car at... car at Iowa and hit the gas.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly.
But, you what I'm talking about here, the analogy I'm very poorly trying to make is that, say, a company like, and to borrow something from Steve Martin, Bank of America is not going to call themselves Fred's Bank if they want to, you know, be successful. They're going to call themselves Bank of America. But I mean, and I think this is very cool. Did you, I guess, when to the point I'm trying to get to, did you find that you had to kind of almost, you know, quote unquote, grow up just a little bit and be like very serious about what you're doing to make sure that this indeed does become successful, at least this RPG?
You know, this actually does go back to the whole transparency thing when it comes down to it. Excellent. Reincorporation.
See, I was getting to a point. It just takes me a little while.
Yes, indeed. What anybody who really tries to start a game company will tell you is that getting any sort of information about how to do that is nigh unto impossible. Like you were saying earlier, there's a lot of sort of paranoia, and these are state secrets that are akin to somebody learning how to make a nuclear missile. First off, no game company is so important that those numbers are that important.
Yeah.
And second off, I don't think that makes for a healthy industry. I don't think that makes for healthy companies. You know, I mean, yes, yeah. On one level, maybe you're giving away some information that your competitors could use. But really, in the game industry, do we have competitors, or are we much better served by having people we cooperate with?
Right.
I don't really feel like there are all these other game companies out there stealing my sales.
And what exactly are these game companies hiding anyway? I mean, it's the game systems and such and the stories, that's all under copyright. And you have to publish it anyway. Sales numbers of how successful or unsuccessful they are. Well, we kind of know what happens to unsuccessful game companies.
Right.
So, you know, who cares about the exact numbers of everything? You know, why is it a big deal?
It was almost upsetting to me. And, you know, I also am somebody who personally tends not to have much of a TMI filter. So I'm a bit of a discloser. And it was very natural for me to bring that to how I wanted to run Evil Hat as we, you know, sort of took this move into trying to be something at least mildly commercial.
What I take away from the story, though, really, is the archetypal success story of the information age or the media age, in that you get someone who goes out there, a group of people that go out there that love what they do, focus their energy on doing it well, and success follows behind that. You know, the good stuff bubbles to the top eventually, as opposed to someone going out there with a business plan and financing and then trying to make success and quality occur.
I made incremental business decisions along the way. I mean, you know, Don't Rest Your Head was published through Lulu first because I wanted to just kind of get the basic hang of print on demand. And each product that kind of came after has been kind of a level up experience where, you know, I'm going to say, okay, well, now we're going to try this kind of additional risk, but always doing it in kind of these increments and so forth, and talking a lot about it as I do it. You know, there's no way in which I would say that we blundered into success. I think there were certainly some deliberate elements to it, but it is very much what you're talking about there, the information age thing of marrying your passion to turn into a motive for producing something of quality, and then using the tools that are out there to foster a community around people's responses to it.
Now, let me ask you a question about that, though. This is kind of the negative side of that equation. One of the things that we have seen within this hobby industry again and again and again is the fact that people who may have a lot of good ideas creatively, a lot of love for the hobby, don't always have the best business or legal sense.
No, God, no.
And invariably end up blundering into some catastrophic situation under which the company suffers or maybe even ultimately folds. And while there may be one story that's on everyone's mind right now, this is hardly the first or likely last story of such kind within the game industry.
I believe that it falls off of two hands if I try to count. Yes.
Yeah. And so I'm curious, what are the steps that you guys have taken to protect yourself? I mean, you mentioned the incremental steps. But is that
that's actually a huge part of it. I mean, it's certainly not the only part, but I'll start there. I think by going incrementally, by saying, okay, for this game, my budget is $100 for some photos that I'm going to run through Photoshop, produce a particular effect, and no money up front to start printing the books through Lulu when people order them. That's a pretty zero risk proposition, right? Mm-hmm. At most, I'll be out $100. And then I sold a couple hundred copies of that game within the first few weeks, which was kind of startling. I really thought I was only going to sell to my 30 or so friends on LiveJournal or whatever, and that would be it. So I kind of defined my limits very deliberately on the first outing. And I think a lot of the set that you're talking about, the people who come into this kind of starry-eyed and saying, I'm going to publish games. And so for my first outing, I'm going to do a full-color hardcover game. It's going to have 800 pages of awesome material. I'm going to do no marketing research on it, and I'm going to print 50,000 copies.
Ouch. You saying that is like watching a train wreck.
And yet it's familiar.
It is. And I have been a part of that dream years and years ago, although thank God we didn't have any money to actually lose on that proposition.
Right. Because you're very well about it.
Yeah. And I know people online, and I know people who are chasing that down. Although I have to switch gears here, because something you said, that something that enabled you is the technology and is, you know, the mm-hmm. print on demand and all that stuff mm-hmm. and how accessible yep. it is. But do you think that that's also something that is at the best diluting role-playing games and at worst just filling it with a whole lot of crap? I mean, if anyone can do this, then that means anyone can do this.
Sure. I mean, that's the quintessential challenge of the information age, too. But mm-hmm. I don't think print-on-demand specifically is achieving that effect any more than PDF did.
Mm-hmm.
But like you're saying there, the cream bubbles to the top.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to happen anywhere. There was actually a conversation I was in online recently where this is kind of a difficult proposition to dig into, but great is hard. Mm-hmm. Good isn't. So this incremental thing that I did with Evil Hat was also in a way marketing research. It's like, okay, do I have the reach right now mm-hmm. to get a game out to at least several hundred people? It turned out I did, and I discovered that without printing thousands and thousands of copies in advance and not being able to sell them.
One thing related to that, where we kind of saw that happen, was with the release of D&D 3.0 and the whole D20 kind of revolution, because the market did get flooded with a lot mm-hmm. of crap.
That is a good thing to point at. Even prior to the explosion of PDF, the market found a way to flood itself with crap anyway.
Yeah. It was almost like 3.5 that the OGL, there was the ability for people to self-publish there. I mean, there was the internet, people can put stuff on a webpage, but there wasn't a whole lot of that, at least to my knowledge. And it was like the OGL and TSR, Wizard of the Coast, or whoever the hell owns them now.
Oh, no, Watsy.
Watsy, yeah. They didn't open the floodgates, but it was like, they gave people permission. They're like, you can do this. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, I'm going to do D20. And then there were a whole bunch of people who were like, you know what? I don't really like D20, or it's not my thing, or I'm just not interested.
Yeah.
But I can do it. If these guys are doing it, I can do it too. And I think that's where a lot of that came out from.
Great is what was very hard for a lot of those people that you were just talking about mm-hmm. to find, because, okay, D20 is good. Was it something that you could then turn into a great thing by actually caring about what you were doing with it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like deeply, passionately, and in a way that produced quality. Because caring doesn't do it alone. Passion doesn't do it alone.
Right.
But it's a good start.
Yep. I hear what you're saying about passion, how it's needed, and I see that in projects that I've worked on that have failed and projects that other people worked on, that you really have to have passion to keep it going.
You do.
But passion does not equal goodness, you know,
nope.
Just because you're passionate about something doesn't equate with it being good.
You can certainly have passion about it, but you also have to have an objective view of what you do. You know, because if you strictly go just with passion, you're going to keep all of your pros in there. And everything is wonderful and you cannot take it out. And you have to go back with that objective eye and say, oh, yeah, you know what? This part is kind of crappy and I should really take it out.
That's one thing that I've mentioned on the show before. I absolutely love Stephen King's book On Writing. And one of his pieces of advice is that when you write something, when you're done with it, you know, you did your initial edits, but this is before you show it to other people. You put it away and you walk away from it for like a week, 2 weeks. You go on vacation, you go water skiing, whatever.
Absolutely.
And then you come back and you have to kill your darlings.
You know what the grand comedy of that is to me, though, is I once had a guy who was a really avid Stephen King reader sit down with me once and work through the major points of Unwriting and show me how he follows almost nothing he recommends in Unwriting.
His advice is good, and if it doesn't work for him, I can't fault him. The guy's a bazillionaire.
Yeah,
so.
But all right. You know, Fred, I got a couple questions here specifically about the upcoming Dresden RPG, because obviously there's a lot of buzz about it, so we have to punch it at some point. But
sure.
Before I get to that, I want to learn a little bit more about you as a person. And my question is this. As a guy who's developing these RPGs, who, I mean, while these may not be D&D, these are still RPGs that get circulation. They get a lot of love. How did you yourself get into role-playing games? And what kind of stuff did you play growing up in the hobby?
Let's see. In about third grade, on the playground, and this guy I know named Eamon is playing with some dice that don't have six sides. And that was about the coolest thing I'd ever seen.
Since witchcraft and devilry.
Exactly.
Satan dice.
Totally. So I asked him what those were, and then he told me about Dungeons & Dragons, and then we'd talk about these games we could play in Waterdeep, only we'd roll up our characters using 3D12 instead of 3D6, because that would make them much more awesome. Thus began a long and strange history of tinkering with every game I got my hands on. But I guess actually a lot of the early phase there was chock full of what some people call lonely fun. You know, I'm sitting at home making my characters. I'm sure going to play them someday.
With real people.
Oh, man.
Real friends.
Wouldn't you just do that forever and ever and ever? We'd just sit there and make character after character and think, I cannot wait to use this guy.
I cannot tell you how many mutants I made with Gamma World. I had some deeply, deeply badass mutated plants is all I have to say.
Oh, yeah. The superheroes I would make for the Marvel Superheroes RPG. I sit there and they had the little pose where you could like color and draw the stuff over the guy, you know? Oh, my gosh. Those things are so great.
So I take it at the time your gaming group pretty much consisted of you, He-Man, and Love-A-Lot Bear.
it was kind of like that. I mean, every now and then I'd find a couple people. There would be some gaming. It got a little bit more successful closer I got to high school. High school featured some like champions and GURPS and things like that. Then I made it to college, wherein I discovered the internet. I discovered it. It's my fault. and thereupon discovered both Amber Diceless, which came to dominate much of my life.
So wait, so you jumped from Hero to Amber Diceless.
And Fudge. Which was
there's no middle ground there.
Originated well, the Fudge was actually the interesting bridge there in a way, because back when these things happened on newsgroups,
eliminate the numbers from the dice, then eliminate the dice.
It's like Hero, except not at all like Hero.
Can't stop a bullet.
Except everything's different.
A lot of my gaming orbited around this whole supers thing. So there was also Marvel superheroes in the mix there too. And Marvel had this interesting idea of traits that were both numeric and words.
Adjectives.
This is something that Fudge had as well.
Okay, stop the print-on-demand presses. So,
not a problem.
That's easy.
You mentioned this interest in superheroes and superhero-type games. You mentioned Marvel. You mentioned Champions, which is now the Hero System and all that, et cetera, et cetera. But that seems to be a recurring theme in the things you're talking about. And if I think about the Fate system and the way Spirit of Century plays, I definitely see some influence there.
You should. I mean, I think because Fate is the grandkid of Fudge, and I think Fudge definitely got influenced from some of those sources itself, independent of my involvement. That comes into play there some. But, you know, also comic books are the grandkids of pulps, too, right? So I think that's why you're going to get that vibe from a number of different directions in Spirit of the Century, specifically.
I find it kind of interesting that you've had all this history
of
superhero games.
Hey, it's Wayne!
You haven't actually made a superhero game yet.
Nope. Sure haven't.
Do you have any plans that, on ever
so I think we should just
that?
Go from the let's just go with yes or no questions for the next half hour.
So was that a sort of short curt no to kind of say that maybe kind of maybe yes? That there's something in the pipe?
I would love to work on
it. No, it does mean yes, right, Pat?
Yeah. Oh, boy. Huh?
Part of the problem with Supers Gaming is that it really is the solve all problems with gaming in this game genre in a lot of ways. And there are a ton of games out there that do it really well.
I want to pry your mouth up a little more. Expand that a little bit. When you say solve all things with gaming, are you talking dice rolls or are you talking role playing?
I'm really talking as a system head. Superhero games really need you to be able to handle all of the wacky shit that happens in comic books, and that's crazy flexibility. And it's crazy flexibility that becomes harder and harder to support the further away you get from something like, say, Amber Diceless, which had, you know, 4 stats and Eric Wujcik, in the background going, hurt your players, hurt them.
That's the coolest game ever.
Yeah. It was a pretty cool game, which is why it dominated a lot of my college life. Yeah.
I've never actually played Amber Diceless. I've had several people tell me, it's like, dude, I've been listening to the show. Amber Diceless is right up your alley. And I just haven't gotten around to looking at it, haven't had an opportunity.
Well, you can get the PDFs on RPG Now. Mm-hmm. But Amber taught a lot of really interesting lessons, which I could get into, but I've kind of had that conversation 20 times. So I'm going to kind of quickly skip past that for the moment. But became such an idiom for most of the people I gamed with. I think in part because it is a licensed thing, it comes with a cast of characters. Mm-hmm. And you were encouraged to, you know, be related to these characters, to have them like integral to your play. Hmm. As a result, you kind of had this vast body of players playing in a style that really most other games weren't encouraging, and all with sort of this common vocabulary, even though the system was light and interesting enough that everyone had their own house rule version of how it was played. Mm-hmm. And actually, house rule version of how it was played is what ultimately gave birth to Fate in the first place, because Fate came about out of my efforts to run Amber with Fudge and my friend Rob saying, you know, there's a real game in there, we can push it further, and thus various things that turned into sort of almost its own system proceeded from there, from a couple big Amber games run with Fudge Dice. But yeah, there's something about, I don't know if it was the game advice that it embedded into it, both from the Eric Wujcik's perspective on the players are your bitches, but also it had just some genius stuff in it. Like the way to get extra character points was not through taking advantages, although that was kind of there too, disadvantages. It was also codifying and legitimizing fanfic as a way to make your character more awesome. It had the whole
background you make up on your character, the better off your character
you sit down and write a short story about your character that is about events that have happened in his past. You give that to the GM. The GM says, here's 5 points for your character.
Oh, so it's like extra credit.
Yeah, it's a lot like extra credit. But what it did was it drew a lot of players to it who were exactly that sort of person who would, you know, sit down and maybe there's a guy in your group who's the artist who's, you know, would draw character portraits. Well, those are a contribution. Maybe there's the guy who brings the snacks. Well, there's a contribution. All these sorts of things got turned into, well, this is how you make your character get more points for building your character, making them getting a little bit of a leg up. And I thought that was really kind of a genius element among many other things. There's just so many things that game did, despite being at the end of the day, rules light, here's some numbers, make up.
I have mixed feelings on that sort of approach to gaming. The fact that's something we've actually been toyed around with our own homebrews over the years is allowing things to be a lot more fluid, a lot more descriptive as opposed to numbers based. But the internal debate within our gaming group has always been that on the one hand, this really opens things up so you can do a lot of stuff in shorthand without 6-page character sheets. You can have much more flexible, interpretive characters. But at the same time, there's another contingent that says, yeah, but the problem is, if you know how to appeal to the GM, if you know the kinds of things they're interested in or latch onto, you can horribly abuse the system. And someone who's more charismatic or more socially connected to the GM is going to get more and get away with a lot more throughout the game.
This is the sound of me nodding a lot.
To me, what you're saying is you have a story, diceless, whatever system, narrative system, and that charismatic person is gaming the system. And as a person who...
That's how you min-max.
Yeah.
You draw the pretty pictures, you write the interesting story, or you talk a good talk.
And to me, as a person who isn't into the number crunching, who isn't into that, I see the exact same problem when we play a heavy, heavy numbers, very hard crunch game where I'm trying to make my fluffy little emo character, whatever. It's like, I don't really care where the dice get put, but somebody else who's like very mathematically minded and very into the crunch is making this combat powerhouse. And to be honest with you, I don't care either way. If somebody wants to really shine in a narrative game, that's what the narrative game is for.
Right.
You know, their success is everyone's success. And if we're playing a tactical, crunchy, number crunchy game, and we have the awesome combat, hard-ass, powerhouse Mr. Invincible, hey, great. That means I'm not going to get shot. He is.
Right.
I think the punchline here is different strokes for different folks, except the problem is, and I don't want to dig into this too much because we'd be straying off the ranch of this episode, but I think the problem comes up with most gaming groups may have a cultural uniqueness to them, but that doesn't mean they're homogenous. And therefore, you're going to get the guy, for example, within our gaming group, we can have someone like Dave, who's real good at crunching the numbers, who wants some rules to the system, versus someone like you, who could probably do a much better job than Dave could of gaming an abstract descriptive system.
Narrative game.
And so the problem you always hit up into is fitting this into the group you're in.
You're hitting on many of the sort of emergent issues that can come out of playing a lot of Amber Diceless, as I did. And ultimately, what came out the other side of it, because Amber Diceless is a good place to go and it is a good place to depart from. Coming out the other side of it, I wanted both things that you're talking about, right? I wanted a little bit more traction in the system as well as some of that looseness. I didn't want to lose the looseness, but I did want to add some crunch. And that's kind of what pushed me towards, well, let me try running Amber with Fudge. And that's what turned Fudge into Fate.
So what I'm kind of curious about is, how do you take a system like Fate, basically you have aspects and things like that, and how do you apply that to something like Dresden Files that is so heavy magic, where these users would have spells, they would have all of this information that they know. How exactly does that adaption work?
After it drove three of us insane, literally the last person who worked on it, Lenny Balsera, who finally got us the complete working magic system out the other side of it. At the end of it, this is a true story, although I was not, thank God, an eyewitness to it. He's sitting in his bedroom in his boxer shorts with like this semicircle of notes around him of all the various, you know, instances of spells getting cast in the series, and, you know, his laptop in front of him, implementation notes, you know, sort of the outline of how the spell casting is going to work, and he's checking through all of them, and then he just starts laughing, and he laughs louder and louder, and his roommate comes down and goes, "What's going on?" And he turns to her in his boxer shorts and, you know, liquor in one hand. They all work. that's the Dr. Short story.
That's a Saturday night for
that
me.
That might be the best game creation story I think I've ever heard.
Yeah, that's how we roll over at Evil Hat with a lot of liquor, at least for a number of the people who worked on this.
So is that what sets independent games and game companies apart from the mainstream, is liquor and nudity?
Well, yeah, liquor and boxer shorts. Yeah.
You know, the stories I've heard from White Wolf, they got plenty of booze.
But not enough nudity.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry, go on. So yeah, to Wayne's question, how are you making Dresden work with the Fate system?
Here's one of the things that Lenny realized, which thank God produced a realization that Fate would actually marry with it pretty well, which is, yes, there's a lot of magic spellcasting, all the stuff going on in the Dresden Files, but particularly the thaumaturgies, the ritual spells, they are really all about telling a story. And when the story is told, you have your spell and the spell is cast. In particular, if you look at the first book in the series, Stormfront, I will try to say this as spoiler-free as possible. There is a guy in it who is casting a spell, and this is from the first chapter, so not that big of a deal, that causes people's hearts to explode out of their chests.
Ew.
From one perspective, the entire novel is the story of him casting that spell a couple times. And that actually works in our system for the longer-term magic pretty well. If you're talking about like the combat magic stuff, that is really about drawing up a bunch of power, shoving it at your target, and hoping to God that you control it enough that it doesn't blow your own face off. And that we did by reversing the order in which most sorts of things normally work in the system, in that you determine what result you want first, you summon up the power to do that, and then you try to control it. as opposed to saying, oh, I want to try to do this. Well, roll it and we'll see if it happens.
So do you deal with things not working right, like misfires?
Oh, yeah. There's a backlash and fallout. Backlash is when the spell energies ground out through you, and fallout is when they ground out through everyone else. So a spell that goes awry can go really awry, and it can fry your brain. It can blow off your hand and bring the house down around you if you're not careful. And if you listen to the rhetoric that Harry Dresden talks in the novels, that is very much a risk. It's why the White Council is so clamped down on new practitioners when they show up, because any one of them could turn into somebody who, you know, accidentally collapses a house on their family because they were trying to bake some cookies with their fire magic.
What an exceptional use of their talents.
Hey, if I had fire magic, I'd be baking cookies all the time.
Right here on my desk. Then I don't have to walk to the oven.
Making the most badass s'mores you've ever seen.
Damn, that's right. Great. I can get into the details of the spell system a little bit more, but I think that's a good level of depth for answering your question initially.
I like the sounds of that. I like the idea of the magic backfiring. I haven't really seen that a lot in other systems that I've seen. I mean, I haven't seen as many systems as a lot of people have, but I like that concept of what you're doing is dangerous and it could have consequences on not just you, but everyone around you.
Have you found that with getting this license, and this is kind of goes back a little bit to what we were talking about a little while ago, but have you gotten the attention of people who don't necessarily play games at all, but follow Dresden Files and are coming in and finding you guys?
Yeah, we've gotten a few. You know, we have a discussion board over on Jim Butcher's online forum. So there's a little bit of that visibility there that I think pulls in some people. And I know, you know, from blog comments and that sort of thing, there have been a few from outside of the sphere who are, you know, saying that they're going to pick this up to try to get into it, but not, at least anecdotally, not a lot.
Is that shaping the development of the RPG at all? Are you looking at putting some extra material in there for people who are new role players that are simply coming in as a fan of that universe?
I wouldn't say that we put a lot of effort into necessarily, well, any more effort than we normally do into saying, okay, from square one, here's role playing. But if you've read some of our games, you might notice that we have a tendency to explain things an awful lot. We'll go on at great length about pretty much everything because, you know, we believe that a good example is one of the most powerful things that you can put in a game. And good advice, not only presenting the tools, but also telling you how to use the tools well is important. But we think that that's of benefit not just to, you know, a newbie gamer, it's benefit to any gamer. So I don't think of it as necessarily a newbie-oriented thing. But, you know, as we were developing the game, it turned out that we had too much awesome for one book. We literally produced far too much text to do it as a single volume, which had been the original intent. So what was at the time a slightly uncomfortable decision to split the book, but considering that it splits into a 400-page book and a 270-page book, that was probably a good call.
Yeah.
You have George R.R. Martin writing with you guys on this? Is that why it's...
No, but we do have Chad Underkoffler, and he is a robot from the future powered by beer.
Have you seen any pushback to that approach, though? Because I know the grand total price-wise is pretty hefty for the two books combined.
Yes, but if you're only a system head, you can get the first book because we made sure that all of the system stuff, short of things like monster stat blocks and stuff, was just in the first volume, Your Story. And the second book, you know, is more for the people who are really into the Dresden Files setting specifically and who want lots of monster stat blocks, that sort of thing. And that second volume is called Our World. And that has what amounts to, over the course of talking about all the characters and all the monsters and so on and so forth in the first 10 books of the series, it also happens to work as a pretty good fan guide for a series that doesn't really have one. So I think that book, hopefully, we're still waiting on Jim to get this to us, but he's working on it right now. It'll also have a short story in that book. So I think that second book is more going to be for the people who are into it only for the setting. So, you know, if you are somebody who's really looking for the comprehensive thing, you're going to be spending an amount of money similar to what you would if you were, you know, say, wanting to get into the comprehensive core set of books for Dungeons & Dragons. In those two books, you are getting your essential equivalent of Player's Handbook, DM's Guide, and Monster Manual. It's just that the Player's Handbook and DM's Guide are essentially interwoven enough that that's your first book. Mm-hmm. But for people whose interest is split, they want to get a good fate-based urban fantasy modern engine, but they aren't really interested in this whole Dresden Files series thing. They can just focus on just the first book. If they know that they hate fate, hate it so much because it breeds with goats or whatever, they can they can go with the second book alone for all of the setting information. And that's going to have about 80% of the setting information, I should say, because, you know, there is the setting stuff that directly impacts on system implementations, particularly spellcraft. So that naturally is going to live in the first book where all the system stuff is. But nevertheless, it does mean that people can split their purchase, particularly if, you know, they have a gaming budget of $50 a month instead of the 90 that it ends up being to get both.
I've got a couple of questions for you specifically about the, you know, the Dresden game. Mm-hmm. I guess the first would be what all types of character classes are available to play, and do they focus mainly on the arcane, or is it mostly arcane, or is it a mix of that and the mundane as well?
Mm-hmm. First off, let me just quickly say that over on DresdenFilesRPG.com, we did a series of blog posts over the course of a few months that focused on each of the templates for characters. I think they number out in about the mid-teens.
Oh, wow.
But really, templates are just sort of recipes. You can kind of, you know, come to this game and say, you know what I really want to do? I want to play a living gargoyle. Can I put together a template with my GM that supports a living gargoyle character type? And you probably could.
Okay.
Cool. But these are the ones that we are sourcing strictly from the series. And actually, if you give me a moment, I will call up that list so that I'm not forgetting someone. But yeah, you'll be able to play wizards. You'll be able to play white court vampires. You'll be able to play Red Court Infectees. That's another kind of vampire. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that once you turn, you're kind of relentlessly evil and an ugly, hideous bat thing.
Oh, nice.
You can play some kinds of werewolves, whether they are merely werewolves of the mind called lycanthropes, who are kind of like your Viking berserkers, or actual turns into a wolf werewolves, or some other sort of creature. You can design a different kind of beast package if you like. You can play true believers, people whose faith is strong enough that the supernatural actually has to pay attention to it and potentially take damage from it. You could be a minor talent, somebody who's got just a little bit of supernatural power. And, you know, I've got the ability to turn things which are red blue. Or, you know, or whatever.
You're a real bastard at the fire department.
Exactly. Those little minor talent focused practitioners to step up a level exist out in the world. These are the people who do not have a command of a full scope of magic like a sorcerer or a wizard do, but, you know, might be like a pyromancer or a kinetomancer or something like that. You can also play champions of various big deal supernatural entities. We call that the emissary of power, and that includes things like the Winter Knight, the Summer Knight from the series, but could also be other things. And the emissary of power template also doubles as the Scion, the character that is half human, half fill in the blank. So that spins off into things like changelings and so forth, which are half human, half fairy. But on the emissary power thing, these are people who are invested with power by a supernatural entity that they entered into a contract with. So you could be the good guy who made a bad deal, sold his soul to hell, and now he's hell's emissary, but he's trying to do good things with the powers that came about it. I've seen that character concept come out of play. We also support playing completely normal people.
Okay.
You get to play total and utter mundanes.
Yes, because the series has Karen Murphy in it, and if we did not support both playing Harry Dresden and Karen Murphy, we would have failed.
You would have been shot, yes.
We would have been shot by Karen Murphy. Uh-huh. So, yeah, that's the pure mortal character, and not to get into the details too much unless another question comes my way. The pure mortals are balanced against the supernatural in that they tend to have a lot more in the way of fate points. As a result, they tend to end up mattering because they have exchanged less of their free will for power. And free will is actually a very important attribute of humankind in the Dresden Files setting.
That's cool.
And bullets hurt.
Yes, they do.
Oh, yeah. Everything hurts in this game. We had two real guiding principles going into the design, and I've just touched on the first one. The first one was this idea that mortals have free will and monsters have their nature. So the more power you have, the closer you get to, you know, being enslaved to your nature, to following the dictates of that, as opposed to being able to choose not to do that. So beyond the player characters, when you're talking about these huge, supernaturally powerful entities, they have no choice at all. They simply are what they are and must be what they are. That's the nature of the extremely powerful. And the system backs that up. The second guiding principle is a thought that Harry has in, I think it's the third book or so, when a vampire dives through the window of his car and is about to try to, you know, rip his face off, as so many things do. And the thought he has is, if he got his hands on me, I was dead. So we said, you know what? That should be true. But at the same time, Harry doesn't end up dead. He ends up, you know, exhausted, scared to death, you know, panting, eking out that last bit of power at the other side of the fight. So we've dialed up the pain And there are some elements of lethality to that, certainly. But it is more about how much is this fight going to take out of you? How much are you going to have to kick your own ass in order to win? All of that is sort of in a soup that the system has been served from.
You know, obviously, having not played the game, but I will say I like that concept. I have always been a fan of the organic magic system. The idea that magic is something that is directly tied to your own attributes, to your own capacities,
yep.
And it's something that draws from you as opposed to the Vancian system where you just memorize and release, and it really has nothing to do directly with you versus a game like Shadowrun where casting the spells is done with dice based on your stats and skills, and doing so can actually drain you or even injure you along the way, and you get this real sense that it's a part of who you are, not just something you're doing.
Right. And in the novels, Harry says, and this is borne up time and again, you can't do magic that you don't believe you can do, that you don't believe is something that you would do. You can't cast a spell that kills someone unless you believe that you're a killer on some level. And if you go so far as to believe that so powerfully that it enables you to cause fire to squirt from your hands and kill someone, that's going to change you. It's going to change
fire if you're lucky.
You know, I think you touched on something that sort of leading to the other question I had, and that was in your magic system, in your types of spells that are available. And earlier in the episode, you mentioned sort of like the big ritualistic ones that are like the really huge, really powerful ones. But you also talked about more of the combat magic, which I liken more into the, you know, like the quick and not necessarily maybe more mundane spells, but the
that's evocation in the
parlance. Okay. And that's what I was going to ask is, do you have specific spells, like, you know, named spells of high level and low level, or is it more of like what you're saying, depending on the character class or the archetype that you're playing, maybe you have a sort of class of abilities, like your pyromancer, and you just say, well, you have the ability to manipulate fire, and it's left up more to the character and the GM to determine the types of spells you cast or what you do, or are they defined?
Yeah, there are specific ways that spells can be built, and we have some examples in the game sourced from the novels.
Okay.
But it does have a freeform element to it. You know, you decide now is the time that you need to come up with a spell that shoots daggers of ice at your foe, and you've specialized in water magic. Well, you can probably pull that off.
Okay, cool.
Your template is going to play into what sorts of kinds of spells that you can do. You know, if you've defined yourself strictly as a pyromancer, as a focused practitioner who doesn't have full command of all the kinds of evocation that you can do, you're going to have to phrase all of your spells within that idiom of fire. You know, and maybe you'll get creative. Maybe you say, okay, I really need to freeze that puddle there. I'm a pyromancer, or I'm mostly specialized in fire magic. I'm going to use my fire magic to shoot a bolt of fire up in the air, and thereby doing so, rip the heat out of that water. Freezing.
Sure.
That's actually a trick that Harry pulls off in the novels at one point, being a mostly fire specialized wizard. But nevertheless, you had to go through some contortions.
Right.
In order to come up with that rationale. And that's going to be true whenever you buy whatever means you're choosing as your vector for coming up with your combat spell of choice.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
You will be able to define some, you know, your favorite spells. You can create a short spell list, which is basically, to borrow a term from D20, it's kind of like your take 10 list that allows you to come up with, you know, a short list of spells that are a little bit easier for you to control, so you don't melt your face off quite as badly that time. But those are kind of your personal list of things that you've practiced.
Right.
You know, I play the guitar, and these are the three songs that I do best. That sort of idea.
So do you approach something like this that's an intellectual property that has heavy fan base and its own history? Do you approach that differently than something that you've come up with on your own? I mean,
that's something I was wondering about too, because if we look at Evil Hat's other flagship products, Don't Rest Your Head, Spirit of the Century, these are things that you guys, through your hard work, made successful. Dresden Files is a very different thing because it's
someone else through their hard work made it successful.
You guys are inheriting something that's successful. And I'm curious about Wayne's question. I actually also have a related question, but we'll take these one at a time. Of what is, or Wayne, if this fits your question, I guess, what is the difference in working on this project versus working on something that was kind of a blank slate to begin with?
Yeah, if there's preconceived notions, how do you deal with that?
Well, first off, you're confronting a vastly, vastly larger amount of daily terror. Actually, to go all the way back to the beginning of the episode, the whole thing about passion isn't good enough to make something good great. You know, I think the other thing that's missing from that equation, if you want to make the good into something great, is being pretty freaking scared that you'll suck. I think where a lot of the failures happen in game publishing in general are people who are pretty darn certain they did something right, because that often is not borne out by the market. You really need to validate and have a certain mania about making sure that you're getting it right. And that is 100% what the licensed product experience is like, because you're approaching it, hopefully, dear God, hopefully, you're approaching it because you're a huge freaking fan. You are like the number one fan of this series, or at least in the ballpark. You can see the number one fan. He's sitting over there in the front row. And coming from that space, you also know what it takes to disappoint yourself as a fan. So, you know, you are your audience there, and you're your critic, and you have a large pool of other people willing to be that for you at any moment with much more enthusiasm than you can possibly weather. I've fielded, because I have not counted them, literally countless requests over the course of, you know, the last several years. Please let me help out. Please let me help you edit. Please let me help you with the design. I've the guy who writes in with the feedback with their resume. I've been playing role-playing games for the last 25 years. I have 5,000 friends, and they're all very excited about your game, and we want to play test. Daily occurrence kind of thing.
That's one thing.
Once during certain parts of the development cycle.
Once you have the intellectual property, do you have people just coming out of the woodwork with, I've been playing a homebrew of this system for years?
Yeah, you do. And you
did that freak you out?
Yes. And you learn very quickly how to let people down gently, or how to start ignoring your mailbox. I tried to go for the former, but, you know, sometimes it had to be the latter.
I guess this kind of ties into one of the latter questions I want to ask you, which is, when many small companies or small fan endeavors start out, they have a certain kind of feel. They're very informal. They're very close to their community. The mm-hmm. community's small and has a certain type of feel. And then as they get bigger and start adding more people and more fans start coming into the fold, there seems to be this tipping point where the entire thing starts to feel so large it's impersonal. It starts to feel very corporate. And I'm curious, as you guys sit potentially on the cusp of that occurring, if you see that sort of process as a bad thing, which is a presumption I don't want to make, what are the steps you're taking to keep that from happening?
Let me start out by saying I don't think it's a good thing. It might not be entirely bad, but I do think that, to be a little mercenary about it, I do think at least the illusion of remaining personal is important. I would like the reality to be pretty close to that. And, you know, again, a thing for the top of the show, some of the transparency stuff that I do, some of the engaging in things like Twitter are a part of keeping it personal, because there's a thing that happens for a fan of something when a person involved in the thing that they are a fan of responds to them personally. And that thing is magic. It's magic in both directions. It helps the fan. It helps the thing that they're a fan of. It grows Evil Hat to have people who are excited about our products because they feel like we are actually listening to them. And I think if we get rid of that, we're going to get rid of some of the value of our brand and some of the investment that our fans feel for our company. So again, that's part of why I'm transparent. That's part of why I put things out there. It's why I try to reply to anybody who says something directly to me on Twitter. It's why I blog my sales numbers and then interact with, you know, people who care to comment. It's why I try to seek out threads about our games on RPGNet and get in there and engage people not as a voice of authority, but as a brother gamer, as their peer. I accept that people will view things that I say as a voice of authority, but I want to rarely exercise that deliberately as a voice of authority. I want instead to come off as, you know, as I'm talking to you, as a human being who just happens to have produced something. Because, you know, that again, like I said, it's magic, because it is also the magic that helps the fan realize that this person that they're excited about is just a person like them. that's something that I've actually seen Jim Butcher do at like his signings. There's a friend of mine who went to a signing that he did in San Francisco, and you know, he walked out onto the little lightly raised stage area or whatever, and they had set up like a table or a podium or some crap like that with chairs behind it and so forth, and he was going to sit there, and there was going to be this table in between him and his fans, and he looked at it and said, "Yeah," and sat on the table and said, "What do you guys want to know?" And what did he do at that moment? He engaged them as people. He didn't say, "I am author, I am voice of authority." I said, "No, I'm on the production as opposed to the consumption side of this thing that we're excited about, but we're excited about it. Let's have a conversation. Let's celebrate it." Regardless of how Evil Hat inevitably mutates under the strange and undiscovered future ahead, I really desperately need to keep hold of that element, staying personal and staying human. Staying a peer with our fans as opposed to some sort of hierarchy, because I don't think that serves either of us very well.
Outside of Dresden, do you guys have anything else coming up that you'd want people to know about?
We are planning on, as soon as Lenny can get out from a mountain of schoolwork that he's gotten himself into, we are going to take the parts of Dresden and Spirit of the Century that are the core system and do a Fate core book. And we're going to make that PDF, just like we did with the early versions of Fate. We're going to make the PDF completely free. And we'll do a print version of the book as well, because that's always kind of been our ultimate goal beyond the wall of Dresden. But because it has been a wall, it's been very hard to see past. So we've got a few things that we're kind of maybe thinking about, but nothing that's aside from Fate Core that I necessarily say that I'm certain we're going to do, other than some side projects that various developers and people who've been involved with the project have kind of been nursing as best as they can while Dresden eats most of their reality. And actually, a number of people from the design crew are also working with Margaret Weiss Productions right now on another licensed thing, a role-playing game based on the TV show Leverage. Now, I'm mostly just the layout guy there, but the things that are being done to the Cortex system to make it support Con Man and Caper stories are pretty glorious, and I'm going to be very excited to see how that one turns out. And then every now and then I sit down with Chris Anrahan and we record another episode of our podcast, That's How We Roll, and that's another one of those talk about the industry but also pursue my transparency agenda. So if that sort of thing that I do is intriguing to you, I'd encourage you to check that out.
All right, I'll be sure to include a link in that to the show notes for anyone who wants to check that show out. Are there any other blogs, places you'd want to draw people's attention to, which I can also
We were talking about the numbers that I put out there earlier, but I don't think we actually ever mentioned where. My blog is at deadlyfredly.com, spelled about like you'd expect, an A in dead and no A in Fred. You can find me on Twitter under the username Fred Hicks. If you come to either of those places, you'll find me talking enough about every other place that you can probably find where you're going. But of course, if you're intrigued by the Dresden Files RPG and somehow have not found DresdenFilesRPG.com yet, go to DresdenFilesRPG.com.
.net.
No, you ruined
it. .net. It's .com.
I hear .net's the new .com.
All right, well, Fred, I want to thank you very much for joining us. It's been great talking with you. And once again, for anyone that's listening, I will be sure to include all the relevant links in the show notes. So if you're in your car or on the subway right now, you can just check feartheboot.com to get that information later on. And Fred, we definitely look forward to seeing this RPG develop and watching it come out and also seeing what you guys have going on with your other products.
Man, I'm looking forward to it, too. I can't wait to get this thing out.
All right, as for the rest of you guys, thank you for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
Later, peace.
Later.
This interview has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2010. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com.